Welcome to episode 178 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here on sescoops.com. I am the Sala Monster. It is Sunday, September 11th, 2011. Thanks to you, as always, for downloading the podcast, and I am doing this show on the 10-year anniversary of the September 11th attacks way back in 2001. 10 years have passed, which is just amazing to me. It just blows my mind that it's already been that long. I was not doing this show 10 years ago. In fact, 10 years ago, I was getting ready for my day, I think as many people were, and happened to have the television on. I think I was watching Good Morning America or some, whatever it was on ABC. Had gone in for a shower, came out of the shower, and as I came out, I saw what was going on television. And it took me a few minutes to really kind of figure out what was going on. I just remember thinking, God, what an idiot. When I first heard about the first plane crashing into the first tower, I figured it was an accident. Some fool had, you know, managed to accidentally fly a plane into a giant skyscraper. And within a couple of minutes, it was pretty apparent that was not the case. In fact, I think when that second plane hit the other tower, everybody at the exact same moment came to the exact same conclusion. And your heart kind of sank, and you had this horrible feeling that just came over you. And at that point, you were just glued to the television. And I had to leave to go on with my day. I had, you know, someplace I had to be. And just passing by all these other people who were watching on other monitors and TV screens and seeing their reaction. And it's one of those things that you can live to be 100 and your mind can start to go. And I still don't think I'll ever forget where I was that day, what I was doing, and obviously, you know, what other people were going through. It's one of those things where if you didn't know somebody directly who was impacted by what happened, then you knew somebody who knew somebody was directly affected. And 10 years later, it's a shame to me that what's going on there at Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan, you know, I pass by there every single day. And finally, they have this Freedom Tower, and they're building, but it's been 10 years. And you would hope that they would be done with whatever they were doing by now. But, you know, it is what it is. I was watching a little bit of the ceremonies and everything on television, and I turned it off just because it's just too depressing. So hopefully everybody listening, if you were in any way affected by what happened, you're you know, having an okay day. And, yeah, it's good to go back every now and then and kind of relive, but just reflect back, so we don't forget. It could be hard to do. You know, History Channel, every single September has this show they have called 102 Minutes, and it's basically just a collection of archived documentary footage from various people who were filming the events of what happened on 9/11 back in 01, and they just take this footage, lump it together, and it's something. I mean, it really kind of chills you to the bone when you watch that. Even if you don't live in New York, if you don't even live in this country, I don't see how you can watch that and not be affected by that. Especially, you know, those images of the firefighters and people who, after that first tower came down, and the other one is still smoldering. And you know in the back of your mind what's about to happen. And you know, there they are kind of marching down the street to go into the other tower to try to, I guess, extinguish the flames and save people. And knowing what happens next, it's just a horrible feeling. And, you know, 10 years later, we finally caught the, you know, dopey bastard who, I won't even say mastermind, because I always kind of chuckle when people throw that word around. Oh, you know, what a criminal mastermind, you know, the people who plotted these attacks and, you know, bin Laden and all that. And, you know, to me, you can use the word mastermind for a lot of things, for people who, you know, knowingly inflict violence and chaos and carnage and all of that around the world and whatever tragedy there may be, because there's a lot of tragedy around the world. I would hardly use the word mastermind for, you know, sick people like that. And thankfully, he's worm food now, and we kind of move on from there. So at the end of the show, I just want to mention, I'm going to actually play some audio at the very end of this week's show. One of the things that I like to do each year, I like not to think about this stuff too much, actually. I kind of just put it out of my mind. But one thing I always do, I go and I watch the first 8.5 minutes back of the very first episode of The Daily Show. with Jon Stewart that aired in the weeks after 9/11 back in 01. I think his show was one of the shows that actually came back on the air the latest. He didn't come back on the air right away. They kind of took their time. That very first episode back, I'll never forget it. You know, they had a cold open, and there was a shot of Jon Stewart sitting at the desk, and he went and just poured his heart out and did this 8.5-minute speech, this monologue, that was just phenomenal, and I think completely captured the essence of what people, at least in New York, people were feeling back then. And yeah, Jon Stewart is great at what he does, so I always go back and watch that. I'm going to play some audio from that at the end of the show, but it's worth going out of your way to watch the entire thing on YouTube if you've never seen it, so I just wanted to mention that. But we move on. We've got a lot of news to get to this week, a lot of news. And the first thing that I want to mention, for those of you who have asked, yes, I am, in fact, going to be going to the Survivor Series in November at the newly renovated Madison Square Garden. I'm very excited about this. This will be my fourth WWE pay-per-view. It's hard to believe I haven't been to more shows than that. You know, I've still never been to a WrestleMania. Hopefully, you know, one of these years that will happen, but the last Garden pay-per-view I was at probably was the Royal Rumble back in 2008. That was when John Cena made his big surprise return. I'm kind of curious in person to see what the new building looks like. You know, it's not like it's going to be completely different, but they've done a lot of work on the interior. I think I mentioned last week the iconic short aisleway in the Garden that WWE would often use apparently is no more, which is very sad. But I will be at Survivor Series. I got the message from Noah Mark, good buddy Noah, who was responsible. We put him in charge of getting tickets during the presale during the week. And he came up with tickets in a pretty good location, dead center. I'd say that's pretty good. So SE Scoops will be in the house at the pay-per-view. I'm sure you've already seen it on the SE Scoops Facebook fan page, which you can go to right now and like if you have not already done so. We'll be at the Garden and look forward possibly to even meeting some of you at Survivor Series. And speaking of Survivor Series, being that I've mentioned it here, I want to make mention of a very interesting commercial that aired on Monday night. I saw this commercial during Raw for the first time. I believe it was the first time it was airing. And it was a local commercial hyping the upcoming ticket on sale for Survivor Series. And the whole basis of this commercial, this entire commercial, was centered around the MSG return of The Rock. And the way that this commercial was voiced over, it made it sound an awful lot like Rock would be wrestling at Survivor Series. You know, they were talking about for the first time in 8 years, he's going to be back in action. And in all honesty, Monday night and all throughout the week, most of the week, I didn't really give much thought to it. I just said, you know what? Of course, they're trying to sell tickets. Rock is going to be at Survivor Series. He's already said he's going to be at Survivor Series. So they're just hyping his return. I'm sure he'll show up. He'll do something physical, not unlike what he did at WrestleMania. But the more I hear about this, and the more I think about, you know, the exact wording that they used in this commercial, it really does sound like Rock is going to be making his in-ring return at Survivor Series this year. And I have some thoughts on this. And I've seen people say that it would be really, really stupid if that happened. Other people, of course, love it, and they can't wait for Rock to come back. I am a little bit biased, I will admit, in this opinion, because now that I actually have a ticket to Survivor Series, hey, I would love to see The Rock back in the ring, you know, in November. Love it. I would love to be in attendance when The Rock wrestles his first match since WrestleMania 20. And so in that respect, I hope it happens. And on the flip side of that, you know, part of the allure of this match they've been building up between Rock and Cena at WrestleMania in April of next year is that The Rock has not wrestled a match since WrestleMania 20. That's a long-ass time to not wrestle a match. And part of the allure of that match was being able to see him back in action for the very first time. So you can make the argument that if WWE went through with this, if this really is what their plan is, and I don't know if Rock is wrestling, it's not been confirmed, but the more I hear about it, it sounds as though this may actually happen. I'm actually okay with that. If Rock is going to come back at Survivor Series, let's say, and there's going to be some sort of match. Where John Cena captains a team against The Rock's team, and Rock and Cena are in the match. They have one or two quick spots, and then quickly get broken up so that you don't have them in the ring too much. I'm okay with that. You know, you can actually use that to help build their singles match into an even bigger match at WrestleMania next year. But my fear is that WWE is going to give the match away. They're going to have them in a Survivor Series match, and then Rock and Cena are going to be in the ring for like 5 or 6 straight minutes. That to me would be a catastrophe. I would just hope WWE is not that stupid, but I'm not willing to bash this idea and say that it's going to ruin the WrestleMania main event or anything like that, because they're really not building Rock's match next year around the fact that it's his big comeback. They're building it around this hatred, you know, this on-air hatred that exists between Rock and Cena. Rock has made no bones about the fact that he wants to kick John Cena's ass. He does not like the guy. And Cena, of course, has all these smarmy responses, and, he doesn't say that he hates The Rock, he respects it, which just makes people hate Cena even more. And they're building it around the fact that it's The Rock's hometown of Miami. You know, WrestleMania next year is going to do big business, regardless of whether or not The Rock has a match before that or not. So, we'll see what happens. I just thought it was very interesting that they kind of just slipped that commercial in there. It got people talking. Maybe that's what they wanted, you know? Survivor Series supposedly is sold out. Tickets went on sale officially yesterday, and they were all gone, although we had some people on our Facebook page who claimed that there were still tickets available. By now, I'm sure they're gone. If they're not, they will be very shortly. Believe me, Survivor Series is going to be sold out this year. And WrestleMania, look, Rock Cena, as long as that match takes place, nobody gets hurt before then, it's going to be a very, very big main event regardless of what happens. If Rock comes back at Survivor Series, it's a homecoming of sorts for him even there, because he made his debut at the Survivor Series in Madison Square Garden back in 1996. So in many respects, it would be quite appropriate for him to wrestle a match there. In many respects, if they build Rock as being part of Survivor Series and don't have him wrestle, it would be a huge disappointment, because the last time they did that was WrestleMania 27. And looking back at WrestleMania this year, I think most people listening to the show would agree that what they did with The Rock was very underwhelming. You know, we were expecting Rock to do more, and he did not. And I don't see how you can do the same thing at Survivor Series. You already promoted Rock as being on a pay-per-view show. He did practically nothing. Yeah, I mean, he rock-bottomed Cena, which led to Cena losing in the main event, but it wasn't enough. People wanted more. And so you have to give them more. And if Rock is going to be there, he has to be part of that show in a significant way. And, you know, you can get away with that. You can take advantage of the fact that it's Survivor Series, put him in an elimination match. But, yeah, there's other questions that come from that. You know, both guys are babyfaces, so who exactly is on what team? You know, how does that work? How do you put heels in a match like that, where you have Cena as a team captain and Rock? One thing I could see WWE doing, which I pray does not happen, I'd much rather have Rock not wrestle if this is what they're going to do. And they do this all the time. Is take two guys who don't like each other, take two guys who are ready to go head-to-head in a singles match, and make them unwilling tag team partners. I could easily see them putting Rock and Cena on the same Survivor Series team as partners. And I'm sure they would build tension between them, but I am so over the concept of putting unwilling partners together as a team. I don't ever have to see that again. And perhaps that's what they're going to do, in which case I'd rather, like I said, I would rather Rock not wrestle, so we'll see if any news officially filters out from WWE on what Rock's participation is going to be. If they tell us, I would assume we're not going to find out until next month. It's still way too early to know exactly what Rock is going to be doing. But I will be at Survivor Series, so whatever they do, I'm sure it will be fun. Got some MMA news, big MMA news here, just to talk about before I get to all the wrestling stuff. I've got a lot of vitriol to spew this week when it comes to these god-awful wrestling shows, so let me get the MMA stuff out of the way first. Brock Lesnar is coming back, in case you haven't already heard. That's kind of a big deal, because Brock Lesnar is one of UFC's biggest drawing cards, and it's been quite some time since Brock fought his last fight. In fact, he's had some very significant health issues. I've talked about it here on the show. Many, many episodes ago, in fact, I actually had one of our listeners, Bill Mitchell, one of our loyal Sound Off followers, record a little bit of audio that I included as part of this very podcast. He had gone through some very similar issues to the intestinal issues that have plagued Brock Lesnar. He's had some very painful bouts of diverticulitis, which is nothing to fuck around with. Vince McMahon has suffered through that as well. And there were a lot of questions about whether or not Brock Lesnar is he going to need surgery? Can he just do other things, change his diet, change his lifestyle, avoid having to go under the knife? Well, he tried that, and it did not work. He was supposed to fight, and then not long before that had to pull out because it just wasn't going away. So he underwent surgery, and now he's coming back, and it seems awfully early for him to come back. But anyway, the news is that Brock Lesnar will face Alistair Overeem on the December 30th UFC pay-per-view show in Las Vegas. I guess they were a little worried to run New Year's Eve, so they're running on the eve of New Year's Eve. It's a Friday night pay-per-view instead of their usual Saturday night show. It'll be a 5-round fight, and the winner will face the winner of the Cain Velasquez Junior Dos Santos fight, which is going to be UFC's first big fight on Fox on November 12th as their first show on the Fox network. And the only fight on that show is going to be the heavyweight title fight between Velasquez and Dos Santos. The winner will meet either Brock Lesnar or Alistair Overeem, depending on who wins their fight at the end of the year. So some very big heavyweight happenings in UFC. Now, Overeem, who was the Strikeforce and Dream Champion, and he had also won a big tournament recently, the K1 World Grand Prix, he signed his UFC contract on September 6th, and then the fight with Brock was announced officially right after that. So this all came together, I think, pretty quickly. And, you know, as far as Brock Lesnar coming back this early, you know, he had surgery in May. That's when he had surgery. Now, think about this. This is a surgery that many people wouldn't even be able to come back from. And maybe Brock won't be. You know, maybe Brock starts training hard in another month or two, and then he has to pull out because he realizes he can't lift that heavy. He can't push his body as hard as he used to. That would be a huge blow to UFC if they promote this fight and then it doesn't happen. But nobody knows. Brock doesn't know. Brock's doctors can't be sure of what's going to happen. And people were not penciling him in for a comeback until at least early 2012. This came out of nowhere. Nobody expected Brock to be fighting this soon. You know, he had surgery in May. 12 inches, a foot of his intestine was removed. That's pretty serious stuff. So, you know, it's going to be a tough fight for Brock. You know, as somebody who has not fought in as many months as he hasn't, and hasn't been able to seriously train at any great, you know, with any great level of intensity, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. But I know there are some wrestling fans who are Brock Lesnar haters because they don't forgive the man for leaving WWE back in 2004. And I always laugh. It's like, really? You have a problem with the guy because he got tired of traveling and his body was breaking down and he wanted to pursue another dream of trying to be a football player, so you're going to hold it against the guy? Really? Get over yourself. So, let's talk about Raw, shall we? Now that we got all that out of the way, my God, what a... You know, if this was a super show, which is what they called it, okay, they called it Raw Super Show, then I shudder to think what a normal Raw would have looked like. This was a terrible show on Monday night. In fact, I only liked one thing on the show, and it's not as though I've got any faith in them going very far with that one thing, but for one night, if that's all it is, it was nice to see, and I'll tell you what that was in a second. Basically, the big pieces of news coming out of this show on Monday night were Kevin Nash revealing that he texted himself at SummerSlam, thus ending the only interesting storyline the company had going. Triple H then firing Kevin Nash, which in wrestling speak means see you in a couple of weeks. Unless you're John Cena, it would mean see you next week. Then they added a bunch of stipulations to the very first Triple H CM Punk encounter, which I'll talk about more in a moment. And two very interesting commercials aired, of course, the Survivor Series one that I just mentioned with The Rock, and an ad touting the new WWE Network, arriving sometime in 2012, which makes me very sad, as I'm convinced that this will be the end of their Classics on Demand channel, which I love. In fact, I noticed this week that they added King of the Ring 1993 to the lineup this week, and King of the Ring 93 is one of my all-time favorite pay-per-views. It's not my most favorite, but it's way up there. It's probably in my top five. I don't know why. It's a weird thing because I go back and I watch King of the Ring 93, and it's just the look and the feel of the show is different for some reason, and I like it. I mean, they had that show in Dayton, Ohio at the Nutter Center, which is not a very big building. In fact, if you watch this pay-per-view, some people might look at that and go, oh my God, this building is so small. But there was something about the intimacy of that building that I just liked. And they had a different announce crew. They had Jim Ross in only his second WWF pay-per-view ever, calling the show with Bobby Heenan and Randy Savage. I thought they did a pretty good job. It was the story of Bret Hart having to wrestle three times in one night. He had that great, great match with Mr. Perfect, a match that I think is even better than their SummerSlam 91 match. And not for nothing, but Bam Bam Bigelow and Bret had a hell of a match in the finals, too. Lawler, of course, attacked Bret at the end of the show to start their feud. It was Hulk Hogan's last big WWF match until the Rock match he would have years later at WrestleMania 18. He lost the championship to Yokozuna. I'm still kind of frustrated that they never took the time to explain to us who the cameraman was whose camera exploded, thus costing Hogan the championship. I've heard, by the way, various stories over the years about who played the role of that cameraman with the big bushy beard. I've heard that it was Jim Cornette in disguise. I've heard that it was Harvey Whippleman. I'm pretty sure it was Harvey, but it's never been confirmed who it was. And in storylines, I guess because Hogan left the company, they never bothered to go back to it. So I guess we're supposed to believe all these years later that it was just some poor cameraman who happened to get up on the apron, happened to swat Jimmy Hart away with his boot when Jimmy Hart tried to get him off the apron, and then whose camera just so happened to explode in Hulk Hogan's face. So even in 1993, they were not always very good about giving you answers to their storylines. But anyway, I really liked that show, and I just figured I would mention that if you have 24/7, you might want to check that out. Back to the network. What are my thoughts on this WWE network? Well, it's not a big surprise. Vince McMahon has been talking about this for quite some time, and I was of the impression that it was not going to be until 2013 that this network was operational. So either something changed, and they think they're going to be able to get it off the ground a little bit quicker, or it will not be ready in time for 2012, but they don't give a fuck, because a year from now, nobody's going to remember that they ran this commercial, and perhaps they just feel the need to start creating a buzz, you know, about this new network that they're putting together. They've been hiring a lot of people. There are guys that work in that studio that spend hours and hours and hours a day digitizing all of the old footage. I mean, they've got just thousands of hours of footage from their library. They've bought out other libraries from other promotions over the years. So they're hard at work on this thing. And as far as whether or not, is it going to be a free channel, is it going to be a premium channel, you know, like an HBO or something like that, I assume it won't be any different than something like the NFL Network, which I believe you have to pay extra for. It's not going to be a basic cable channel like USA Network or you know, FX. I'm not saying it won't have commercials. I'm sure it will, but you know, you're going to have to pay something for it. I've had people ask me, you know, is WWE moving all of their current programming there? You know, because that's kind of what the commercial made you think. I mean, this was the week of very confusing commercials for WWE. You know, on the one hand, they want you to think Rock is wrestling at Survivor Series, which he may or may not be. And in this commercial, the way they voiced it made it sound like all of their programming was going to be moving over to this new network, which, you know, maybe in 5 years that could happen. You know, if USA Network ever decides to dump WWE, it'll be nice for them to have their own network because they could just move all their stuff there. But no, absolutely not. They have a deal with USA. They're very happy with USA. USA is very happy with them. USA is in a lot more homes than the WWE network will be, if that network ever does see the light of day. And it will be a network that airs classic content very similar to what 24/7 currently does. They want to create original content. I don't know what that would be. But that's the plan as of right now. And it's very, very hard to get the type of clearances that you need to get your cable station into people's homes. It's not easy at all. In fact, on my cable service here, we still don't have. I don't think we have the NFL Network. We have the MLB Network if you're a baseball fan, but it's very, very, you know, difficult to do that. I mean, even here in New York City, the on-demand channel is part of my cable company's lineup, and that took a couple of years to get them to carry that. Time Warner Cable, which is probably the biggest cable provider in New York, still does not carry WWE 24/7 on demand. You know, they had some sort of impasse that they had, you know, reached with WWE. They couldn't get beyond it. They continue to negotiate, and they've made absolutely no progress. So if you're a Time Warner subscriber, you're probably still pretty pissed off that you don't have WWE 24/7. Well, now we're talking about a full-fledged cable network. We're not talking about some video-on-demand channel. We're talking about a real cable network, and they're going to have a lot of problems. Look at the problems that they've had with WWE films. I mean, if there's one similarity, I think, that I could draw between the two of them, one of the reasons I think WWE films does not do well, besides the fact that many of their movies suck, is the fact that they use the WWE name. The WWE name in the general public is like poison. And honestly, when people hear WWE films, they laugh. They shake their head, they sigh, or they shrug their shoulders. It doesn't carry a lot of value to people if you're not a wrestling fan. And so calling it the WWE Network, I don't think is going to do them any favors. I'm just saying, it's their network. They can call it whatever they want to, but they might want to think about giving it a different name. Maybe Solar Plexus Television. If you're an old fan of Gorilla Monsoon commentary, you'll know where that term comes from. There's any number of things that you can do, but still a lot of questions to be answered as far as this new network is concerned. I think it would be more frustrating for me than anything else, just because the on-demand channel is great. You play content whenever you want. You have to be careful, because if you don't watch something quick enough, it may only be up for a week or two, and then the content rotates, so you can easily miss something. I've missed a lot of stuff. I missed a lot of stuff that I wanted to watch on there, but I'm just too lazy. I never get a chance to watch it. But still, it's on demand. It's there for you to press play whenever you want to and watch it. And with a regular network, I think it would be very frustrating for me, because it's a 24-hour, constantly evolving, rotating content on the network. And I would almost feel like I need to be parked in front of that television 24 hours a day so I don't miss anything. And I'd be more frustrated that I would be missing all of these shows when I have to go to work and such. So anyway, we'll find out more in the months ahead. And as we learn more, I'll talk more about it here on this show. So back to Raw. Let's grab the pooper scooper and dig right into this dog shit, shall we? Let's talk about the good first. We're going to do the good, the bad, and the ugly. The good. This will be quick. There was only one thing on the show that I liked. I felt genuine happiness for Zack Ryder on Monday night. First, he got a well-deserved video package dedicated to his YouTube show and his internet championship, which I still maintain that internet title that he created is so much better looking than the WWE championship belt, and it should not be the case. Then Zack gets the team with Jerry the King Lawler on the flagship show. Here's Zack Ryder, a featured performer this week on Monday Night Raw, teaming with the King, and he got to score the winning fall on one of the former tag team champions. Now, will this lead to a bigger push for him? Is this going to lead to bigger things in his future? I hope so. I really do. But for one night, if nothing else, for one night only, it was really, really cool to see someone who took the initiative get noticed and actually be recognized for his hard work. You don't have to like Zack Ryder as a performer. I know there's a lot of people who don't get all the Zack Ryder love. They just don't. They don't think he's special. They think he's an average worker, ripping off the Jersey Shore. They don't get it. It's not about that. It's not about that. I don't like the Jersey Shore either. And I don't think Zack Ryder's character, his gimmick, is one that is conducive to being in a WrestleMania main event, okay? But you don't have to be a WrestleMania main eventer to make good money and have some success in the wrestling business. Nor does Zack Ryder have to have this gimmick for the rest of his career. He's doing it to get noticed. And guess what? It's working. He's doing something that actually brings pleasure and joy and happiness and laughter into people's lives. I get a kick out of watching his internet show every week. Some of them are better than others. You could say the same thing about Raw or SmackDown or Impact, although most Impacts are terrible. But the point is, he's entertaining. And WWE loves to always throw in our face about how we entertain people. We're storytellers. We're here to make people laugh, and we're here to make them cry, and this and that. Well, they make us cry more often than they make us laugh, for all the wrong reasons. Zack Ryder's a funny guy. His show is very, very original, and now he's got a lot of other guys in the back doing cameos, and it's just a fun thing to do. And as a worker, whatever, he's okay. He's average at best. He doesn't light my world on fire, but that's okay, because they don't have a lot of people in that company, quite frankly, left over who are tremendous in-ring, technicians or anything like that. I'll let the Daniel Bryans of the world give me matches like that. But there's definitely a place on TV each week for Zack Ryder. You've got 2 hours, actually 4 hours if you count SmackDown, of television real estate that this guy can be on. And I know he's been Teddy Long's assistant on SmackDown. That's great. He deserves a spot on Raw each week. You know, until the time that people just don't react to him at all and they chant boring and they sit on their hands, until that happens, he's getting a reaction. Some cities, he gets a bigger reaction than others. So put him out there. You know, let him sink or swim. Let's see what he can do. Let's see if he can make you money. Apparently, his t-shirt and his headband are doing pretty well on WWE Shop. Guess what? That's money in their pocket. So hopefully he gets a chance and we see him on television a little bit more each week. And that was literally the only thing on the entire show that I liked on Monday night. The only thing. Let's get to the bad. And I just want to put a little disclaimer up here first that if we have anybody listening to the show who is easily offended by adult language, adult content, this might be the part of the show that perhaps you might want to fast forward through, or perhaps you should probably just stop listening to the show altogether at this point. Now, first thing I want to talk about here, I take back everything I said last week about the CM Punk Triple H Kevin Nash storyline. I sat here, I tried to defend it, I tried to explain that it made sense for the most part, except for the thing about announcing the Kevin Nash match and then pulling it, which made no sense since they knew about it in advance. They didn't even have to announce that. Aside from that, I thought it made sense. It was intriguing. I'm a sucker for a good mystery, and I wanted to see where it went. And 1 week later, they flushed it all down the toilet. They had to go and fuck it all up to where nothing makes any sense at all, and to add insult to injury, they blow off the mystery of the text message in the absolute worst possible way. I mean, I could have asked each and every person listening to this show right now, including those of you still in elementary school, to submit your own ideas to me on how this storyline should unfold, and I am 100% convinced that not one of them would have been as lame as what they went with. So let's start with that, okay? Let's start with that, shall we? We are supposed to believe that Kevin Nash found his way into Triple H's office backstage at the Staples Center, that Triple H happened to not be in his office, that he happened to leave his cell phone laying around for whatever reason. And by the way, what kind of COO doesn't have his cell phone on him at all times while he's on the job? Explain that to me. Anyway, we're also supposed to believe that he sent a text message to himself and then hightailed it out of there. What is the point of this? Why couldn't he just say that, you know, go back to the beginning, and why couldn't he just say that he got a text message from an unknown friend saying, hey, it's me, you know? On top of that, the Staples Center just so happens to have footage of this that they send to Triple H 3 weeks after the fact. You know, they would have been better off trotting Rikishi back out there to tell us that he did it for The Rock. Hell, why not? Why not? When Hunter confronted him about all this and Nash admitted it, his great explanation for doing so, okay, Kevin Nash's great explanation for why he did what he did was, quote, I made the WWE cool again. That's what he said. Boy, Triple H wasn't kidding when he said this guy lies all the time. All he does is lie. That was a shoot. Now, if this wasn't bad enough, they felt the need to rush the first Triple H Punk match onto Night of Champions. I talked about that last week. You know, some people will defend them and say that it wasn't their fault. They wanted to do Punk and Nash, and the Nash medical situation kind of, it was a curveball. Even if I say, okay, I sympathize with them, which I don't, but if I did, they feel the need to add stipulations to their first match. I mean, what is this, TNA? Vince Russo is notorious for booking gimmick matches first, which then lead to a straight singles match, which is the complete ass-backwards way that it's always been done in wrestling. And you know why it was always done that way in wrestling? You want me to let you know a little secret why things are done the way they are? Because it works. With few exceptions, the reason that formulas exist, the reason that things are often done the way that they've been done for years, is because they have a proven track record of working. So, for example, if you're going to start a feud with two guys who have never had a match before, you don't start them off in a TLC match and build to a regular singles match, because that would be stupid. So in effect, that's kind of what they're doing here. Triple H and CM Punk have never had a match before. It's hard to believe. You have very few of those matches left in WWE. Punk's been around for about 5 or 6 years. Triple H has been there for about 50. They've never had a singles match before. And in their first match, they feel the need to add all of these stipulations. Which makes me wonder if Russo is booking both shows now. So they made the match no disqualification. Fine. That's one thing. That's not even what pissed me off. Why in God's name would they put Triple H's COO title on the line in this match? He hasn't even been in the role for a full 2 months yet. What has he really done anyway? And in my opinion, it completely telegraphs a screw job of some kind when Triple H wins this match. Now, maybe he won't win. Maybe he won't win. But to me, when I first heard that, my first thought was, well, they couldn't make it any clearer that Triple H was going to beat CM Punk. And I always figured he would, because, come on, it's Triple H we're talking about here. But beyond that, it would have made sense. If you're going to keep this going for a while, then you have Nash interfere. And apparently Nash won't be interfering, I guess, because he's filming a movie role. He may not actually be allowed to. I don't know. Maybe he still will. But, you know, that was my first thought. Triple H is going to win. It's going to be some sort of screw job. Maybe Triple H plays dumb again if somebody interferes on his behalf and he pretends not to know about it. But why would you add that stipulation to this match? Their very first match, and you're putting... Triple H is okay with putting his job on the line. CM Punk says, I want you to put your COO title up for grabs, where if I beat you, you are no longer the COO. And Triple H says, deal, you got your match. Plus, I'm not finished yet. Oh, no, I'm on a roll here. Is it just me, or did Kevin Nash not say the week before on Raw that he would gladly sit home and collect his guaranteed money if Triple H fired him? Did he not say that? The same guy who's been yakking and yakking about bringing guaranteed money to the business, which is horseshit, by the way. Guys already had guaranteed money in wrestling before Nash came along. But all of a sudden, he's upset that he got fired. Now, at least here, you can argue that he's not angry about that. He's angry about the fact that his best friend picked Punk over him. But fine. Then don't script him to talk about how getting fired wouldn't bother him a week earlier. So, yeah, I pretty much hated everything they did with this angle on Monday night. As if that isn't bad enough, in the opening segment, CM Punk has to go and steal my material by mentioning Super Shredder after I just so happened to mention that on 177 last week, and I played a clip from The Secret of the Ooze last week. If I didn't know any better, I kid CM Punk. I still like him. What else on this show did I not like? Aha, the main event. They did an elimination match at the end of the show. John Cena, Sheamus, Alex Riley, and John Morrison against Christian, Wade Barrett, Dolph Ziggler, and Jack Swagger. Alberto Del Rio was back this week. He basically spent the entire show stirring up shit backstage amongst all the heels, giving them all the reasons why they should hate John Cena and want to take him out. So when they ganged up on Cena at the end of the show, that's when Teddy Long comes walking out, and he makes the main event. They actually let Jack Swagger tap two different guys out with his ankle lock in this match, John Morrison and Alex Riley. And I'd classify that as a good thing, except the only reason they did it was to further the storyline with Dolph Ziggler being jealous and, you know, getting all the attention from Vicky Guerrero and all that. And I mean, it's not as though they've got any real plans for Swagger, let's be honest. So what's the point? In the end, it came down to Cena all alone against Swagger and Ziggler, 2-on-1. Do you really need me to tell you what happened next? I will anyway. Cena pinned Dolph with an attitude adjustment. Then he countered Swagger's ankle lock into an STF, tapped him out to get the victory. Cena is the one fighting for the WWE Championship at the pay-per-view. So I'm okay with him winning a match, but this still left a bad taste in my mouth. It probably was from the vomit, as a matter of fact. Del Rio ran down to attack Cena, got laid out with an attitude adjustment himself. It was the same Raw ending that we have seen 1,000 times before. The ugly on this show. Beth Phoenix pinned Eve Torres to become the number one contender for the Divas Championship. She'll get her match at Night of Champions in Buffalo. The match isn't the reason I'm putting this in the ugly category. It was what else? The announcing. Whatever progress they made 2 weeks ago, whatever goodwill they had built up with me is now completely gone. I was a fool, I admit, to think that it would last. Michael Cole was unbearable this week. Unbearable. He does this thing where he talks at the speed of light, and he does this high-pitched squeal that just makes me want to turn the TV off, look him up in the phone book, drive to his house, rig it up with C4, go hide in the bushes until he pulls up in his driveway, wait for him to go inside, and blow the whole fucking place to kingdom come. That's the rage that this man causes to boil over inside of me. And it would be fine if he were a heel character like a wrestler. He's a fucking announcer. Okay? It was so bad that even Joey Styles had to go on Twitter and call for a Loser Leaves Raw match between Michael Cole and Jim Ross, because he couldn't take the constant bickering. I'm not the only one who complains about this. People say, well, it's just the announcing. Stop bitching. If you don't like it, then mute the television. I am not the only one. Joey Styles, who works for WWE, is complaining about the same thing on Twitter. Okay, and there's no angle that he's trying to start here. He posted a comment that said, I cannot enjoy this show because you guys are screaming at each other. Oh my God. Jim Ross on Twitter had to go on there and say that he will no longer bother engaging Michael Cole in any verbal battles, he said. He will focus on the talent, which is noble on his part, except that it's not going to stop Vince McMahon through Cole from trying to get under his skin every week. You know? I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, it really affects my enjoyment of this show in a negative way. It puts me in a foul mood. So I say go ahead. You know what? If that's what they're going to do, go ahead. I've noticed that every time I do a show where I rant on something, if I tear into TNA or I tear into WWE, my download numbers shoot up. It's great for my show. So have at it. You know, at least I'll benefit from it, because your product sure as hell isn't going to. I hated this show. And in other Raw news, Hugh Jackman is going to be the guest host. This fucking concept is not dead yet. He's going to guest host Raw the night after the pay-per-view on September 19th, the next big Raw Super Show from Cleveland, Ohio. And if he brings his claws with him and rips out Michael Cole's vocal cords with them, he will officially replace Bob Barker as my all-time favorite guest host. Because otherwise, if he doesn't, it's just a waste of time. Linda McMahon is going to be running for Senate again in 2012. Foregone conclusion, pretty much, but it was confirmed this week, according to an article in Thursday's New York Times, and another story that got picked up by the AP. Linda McMahon has confirmed that she will indeed be running for Senate in the state of Connecticut for the seat that is being vacated by Joe Lieberman next year. So for all you people who were hoping that she wouldn't run and that we were going to have a return to the Attitude Era and all this other stuff, I just point and laugh at you, because anybody with any sense of how these things work, anybody with half a brain, could have known that she would be running again. And, you know, WWE to some degree has been pushing the envelope a little bit with some of the language they use and stuff like that. And I've liked it. I would like to see more of that. And I have a feeling that we are going to be in for much less of that as we head into 2012. So let's get away from WWE for just a second here, because for all the hatred I had for that show on Monday night, and I have not seen SmackDown yet, so I can't comment on it, I've got a lot to say about everybody's favorite wrestling promotion, Total Nonstop Action, or Impact Wrestling, or whatever the fuck they want to call themselves. First, let's talk about Kurt Angle. This is not so much TNA's fault, but it kind of is. I'll talk about that. Kurt Angle got arrested for DUI. Literally, the story broke right after I finished recording last week's Sound Off, so I didn't have a chance to talk about it. What can be said? I mean, you know, I've got a joke. I thought of this earlier. I had to put it in the show. What do Kurt Angle and Roger Rabbit have in common? I'll give you a second. Give up? Fine. They both say that they were framed, and they both live in Toontown. Kurt Angle had claimed at the beginning of the week that he was framed, or his lawyer said that he was framed, which I could have sworn was something that he and his lawyer had said at least one time before when he had gotten busted for a similar offense. So apparently, law enforcement up and down the East Coast, they have it out for Kurt Angle. They keep framing the poor guy. I mean, God, I feel sorry for him. Police report from Virginia State Trooper C.R. Scally, which is kind of a cool name, actually, for a state trooper. He stated that Kurt Angle had a blood alcohol content level of 0.091, which is right above the legal limit, when he tested him after being pulled over last Saturday night. Okay, so that's what the officer says. They said the 0.06 test reading that Engel and his lawyer have mentioned this past week was the result of a second test that was administered at the police station the following morning. He also said that Kurt Engel failed a number of field sobriety tests, including one where he was asked to count backwards from 53 to 48. He said Mr. Engel started with 50, then went back to 52, and ended at 38, missing and mixing up several numbers. His eyes also appeared to be glassy and bloodshot. Now, Engel claims he's innocent. He, will plead not guilty. And this is now his third DUI arrest while working for TNA, or as I may start referring to them, total nonstop alcoholics. He was arrested in 2007 on a charge of driving under the influence after being reported by a woman who claimed that he almost hit her while leaving a local restaurant. It should be noted that he did end up being cleared of those charges the following year. Now, this year, in March, Engel was arrested in North Dakota and charged with being in control of a motor vehicle while intoxicated after failing a field sobriety test. He later pled guilty to those charges and was sentenced to a year of probation and a 10-day suspended jail sentence. And while still on probation, mind you, he gets arrested again last weekend. And, of course, as far as we know, TNA has done nothing to reprimand Engel, which just makes them look so bad, coming off the heels of Dixie Carter firing Matt Hardy. You know, if they take the championship off of Kurt Engel at the No Surrender pay-per-view tonight, I guess we could take that as a punishment of sorts, but even if they take the title off the guy, is that really a punishment? Really? I mean, this is one of the many, many things that makes TNA look so Bush League compared to WWE, which I know they hate. They can't imagine why people look at them that way. What do you think WWE would do if they had a performer, okay, or two or three performers, who racked up one DUI arrest after another? True, they didn't do anything to Alex Riley, as far as I know, but hey, first offense, lesson learned. You know that if it happens again, he's getting wish well in his future endeavors, because they're not going to put up with that. But apparently TNA sees nothing wrong here. In fact, if Kurt Angle is to be believed, TNA just rewarded him with a new 3-year contract. In an interview with MovieLine.com earlier this week, at the premiere of his new film, Warrior, well, it's not really his film, he just happens to be in the film, Kurt Angle announced that he just signed a new 3-year deal with TNA Wrestling. He says that he wasn't allowed to do any films while he worked for WWE due to his schedule, so TNA gives him the chance to do movies, and if it conflicts with the schedule, they work around it. He said, it's a much better situation for me, so I actually signed a new 3-year deal today with TNA. And again, this interview was conducted earlier in the week. My question is this. Wasn't it back in June that Kurt Angle announced on Twitter that he had just signed a new 3-year deal with TNA? Now he claims he just signed one this week after his arrest? So, basically, here's the deal with Kurt, okay? Kurt is right up there with the likes of Hulk Hogan and Matt Hardy in the you can't believe a word that comes out of the guy's mouth category, okay? So it's entirely possible that he's talking out of his ass. In fact, I'm sure he is. But you would think that if that were the case, someone from TNA's PR department would put out a statement refuting it. And so far, TNA has done what they do best, remain silent. Let's move on to the next jailbird here, shall we? Let's talk about Jeff Hardy. Jeff Hardy. If TNA has nothing else, they have impeccable timing. On the same day that Jeff Hardy returned to television, after months of sitting at home, he was finally sentenced to drug charges. Now, these charges were first brought against him 2 years ago, and he's gotten continuance after continuance after continuance, and they knew that he was due to go back to court on September 8th. And they did the tapings from, where did they do the tapings from? They taped their TV show from, not Fayetteville. Where the fuck did they just tape their TV show from? I just completely forgot. Hold on, everybody. Let me go look this up here. Huntsville, there you go. Sorry about that. Huntsville, Alabama, okay? So when they did those tapings, they taped two TV shows, and they taped Jeff Hardy's return to air on the same day he went back to court. Not too bright on TNA's part. In fact, I poked fun at them last week, I think, for doing that. They put themselves in that position. So, yeah, he finally gets sentenced, and he got 10 days in jail, 30 months of probation, and a $100,000 fine as part of a plea deal that will keep him out of prison. He pled guilty to 2 counts of possession of a controlled substance with intent to deliver a controlled substance, and a single count of conspiracy to traffic in a substance containing opium, all of which are felonies stemming from the arrest. It was actually September 11th. It was on this day in 2009 that Jeff was busted. All the other counts against him were dropped in return for the plea. He also agreed to remain in a drug abuse treatment program, and his lawyer requested that Jeff be allowed to travel outside of North Carolina to work for TNA. That request was granted. Some more information here that I don't think ever came out, quite frankly, so I've never mentioned it on the show before, but I found it kind of interesting. According to the story in the Fayetteville Observer, the district attorney said that the raid on his home back in 2009 came after employees at a FedEx distribution center called police about a suspicious package. The package was addressed to Hardy from a fan in Florida named Thomas Ray Cruz, who met Hardy after a show and offered to supply him with pain pills. Hardy's attorney told the judge that his client turned to painkillers to deal with the pain from pro wrestling. It contained a Maxwell House coffee can filled with over 260 prescription hydrocodone painkillers. Police resealed the package and had the pills delivered to Hardy at his home. When he accepted the package, the cops raided his house. They found other drugs there as well. His lawyer said that Jeff got involved with the pills to, again, cope with the pain and damage that his body had endured as a wrestler. And keep in mind that Jeff Hardy is only in his early 30s. So just imagine what he's going to be feeling like when another 10 or 20 years goes by. And it really does make you think about that wrestling style that him and his brother and, you know, all those ladder matches and the crazy matches everybody had 10, 12 years ago. There's a reason that WWE has what they call a safe style. You know, there's a reason that they've toned down on a lot of that stuff. For all the people who bitch and they want things to go back the way they were, this is one example, quite frankly, of why I don't think they should go back to the way they were. I didn't have a chance to see Impact Wrestling this week, aside from the final segment with Hardy's return. I did go back and watch that. He came out looking like his dog died. Well, I guess his dog did die in a pretty horrific way not too long ago, so perhaps that was a bad analogy, but he looked very sad, and he came to the ring and admitted to being messed up at Victory Road back in February, and he said he let everybody down. Crowd started chanting his name, although it sounded to me like they were playing with the crowd noise a little bit here, which is a surefire way to ruin a show. Just ask everybody who watches SmackDown each week. It just takes you right out of the show. And I don't know how it was for the rest of the night on Thursday, but I noticed it here. So finally, Jeff asked for one more chance. The crowd chanted one more chance. And he looked sad again, almost like he was trying to cry, but he never did. And then he just walked off. So I will say that he did a very good job of looking somber, even in the absence of any tears. But again, how many chances can a person get? You know, he's now a convicted felon. He should have been fired after that match with Sting. I just remember watching that and being, you know, I don't even watch TNA pay-per-views all the time. You know, I've seen pay-per-views from TNA very, very seldomly because, and obviously I'm not the only one. Nobody buys their pay-per-views. But it's still a pay-per-view. And if I were a paying customer, I wasn't a paying customer for Victory Road, and I was appalled and angry by what I saw in that match. I can only imagine if I had actually spent $45. And your big main event, your big, I think, first time ever encounter, Sting versus Jeff Hardy, goes down the way that it did. It was an absolute embarrassment to the company. And he should have been fired in February. And, of course, he was not. And I'm all for forgiveness for those who deserve it, but I'm so tired of the Hardys. I find it really, really difficult to have any sympathy for the guy. I really do. It's just, you know, you get to that point where you feel like a fool, you know. You kind of feel sorry for the person. Ah, come on, give him another chance. And then he fucks up, and it's like, well, give him one more chance. And then he fucks up again, and he fucks up again. And it's like, well, boy, I look like a dumb shit now because I actually felt sorry for the guy. And I think I've reached that point where I just don't. You know, Matt Hardy is, he's put a couple more videos out. I have not watched a single one of them. I have no intention of watching them because I just, I don't care. You know, you reach that point where it's like, I can't even be bothered by it. And all of this TNA stuff, it got me thinking. You know, I was at the gym yesterday and I was actually thinking about TNA. You know, one of the things you could do when you go to the gym is get all your anger out. You know, it's very therapeutic in that way. So, of course, I had TNA on the brain. I was thinking about the show and going over all this stuff, and it hit me. It hit me that I've come to the realization that there's something TNA has to do, and they won't do it, of course. Absolutely not. They won't do it. But they should. They should have done it a long time ago, quite frankly. But what's done is done. We look ahead. We look to the future. And what they need to do is this. TNA needs to get rid of Hulk Hogan, Eric Bischoff, Kurt Angle, and Jeff Hardy. And, you know, all of them are legends in their own respect. You know, Hogan, I mean, speaks for itself. Bischoff will go down as somebody who had more failures than successes in wrestling, but the success he did have in the mid-90s with WCW was huge, absolutely huge for the wrestling industry. Kurt Angle is one of the greatest wrestlers of all time. Jeff Hardy is a guy who came from being literally a job guy on television in his teens to being a world heavyweight champion, and you know, clearly has ravaged his body in the process, and there's something to respect when you think about that. But let's go through this one by... And by the way, before I even do that, I would get rid of all these guys. The one guy that I would keep when it comes to these legends that TNA has on their watch... Okay, and I know they have other guys under contract like Scott Steiner and all that, but they're mid-card players. The guy that I would keep if I'm TNA, who deserves a spot in TNA, if he wants to continue having one, is Sting. Okay? Say what you want to about Sting. He's 53 years old. He's got a bad shoulder. He's not the worker he once was. He doesn't look physically the way that he once did. Although, I will say, at 53, especially when you compare him to guys like Flair and Hogan and all this, Sting looks very, very good for his age. He's, you know, he's in decent enough shape where you don't look at the guy and go, oh my God, he looks terrible. He's fine. And a lot of people are very tired of the gimmick that he has with, you know, copying the Joker. And I admit, He's taken it from something that I enjoyed in the first week or two, and he's gone so over the top with it. I mean, I can't even see him anymore. He's gone so far over the top with it. But Sting is a guy who has been in TNA now, off and on, mostly on, for many, many years. I mean, God, Sting probably first goes back in TNA from the early days, probably their first two or three years in existence. And he's pretty much been with the company consistently throughout, you know, never gone to WWE. And has had some you know, okay matches. Has had some pretty good matches as well. He's been champion many times. He's a guy that seems likable by all accounts. I've never heard anybody behind the scenes call Sting a bad name or say that he's not approachable or he's a real prick or a prima donna or anything like that. And when Paul Heyman was going to take over the book with TNA, it's been talked about that his plan was, you need to get rid of every single person over the age of 40. You get to keep one, okay? One legend, one big name from the past is what you get to keep, and everybody else gets fired. And Dixie Carter said, I can't do that. Dixie didn't want to do that, and she didn't want to cede power to Heyman to fire other people. That was the sticking point. That's why Paul Heyman is currently not working in TNA, okay? And my gut tells me that that one guy that Heyman would have kept was probably going to be Kurt Angle, because Angle is still younger than Hogan and Flair and Sting and all these guys. And Heyman knew Angle from WWE when they worked together. He likes Angle. He knows Angle is a tremendous worker. My gut tells me Angle would have been the one guy that Paul kept. And they would have built the company around Samoa Joe, Christopher Daniels, AJ Styles, Jay Lethal, and all of these other guys. Okay, that was the plan. Well, my plan, Sting gets a spot in TNA. He gets to stay if he wants to. I wish he would tone the character down. But look back on Sting's tenure in TNA. Okay, when has Sting ever done anything to truly embarrass Total Nonstop Action? When was the last time that Sting was caught backstage in a state that he was in no condition to perform? Or when was the last time we heard about Sting getting pulled over for a DUI? Or that he was caught, you know, he got busted for a drug test? Or something embarrassing that just makes you shake your head and makes us all wonder if TNA is going to fire the guy. Oh, is, you know, he deserves another chance. I don't remember hearing a single story ever about Sting embarrassing the company. He goes out there. Maybe he's not what he once was, but he goes out there, he tries hard, he's had some good matches, he can work with pretty much anybody, and TNA has given him some really stupid shit to work with, and he's also had some pretty good matches, too. I remember he had a good match on pay-per-view once with AJ Styles. Sting, in many ways, as a legend, okay, as a guy that you can look at and have respect for and has accomplished a lot in the wrestling industry and is now, in many ways, trying to give back. You know, he's working with the younger guys and all that. I've never heard him having an overly big ego in TNA or refusing to put anybody over or anything like that. Sting, in many ways, is the model citizen. You know, he is what you would expect somebody in his position to be like in a company that should be built around younger talents. He has not one time done anything to embarrass TNA. All of these other dipshits have done numerous things to embarrass TNA. And by the way, you can add Ric Flair to that list too. Hogan, Flair, Bischoff, Angle, Hardy, gone. Let's take Hulk Hogan, for example. Hulk Hogan came into this company, they had high hopes. They tried to get Hogan many, many years ago, it didn't work out. They shot an angle in Japan, Hogan wrestled the match, there was a press conference, Jeff Jarrett was there, Jeff Jarrett smashed a guitar over Hogan's head, and the match never happened, which shocked me, because in many ways, you know, Jarrett got one over on Hogan. I mean, they ran that footage on TNA Wrestling for the longest time, and Hogan never got his retribution. Years later, they finally got the Golden Goose, okay? They got Hogan and Bischoff to come in together, and they thought that this was going to be a turning point for TNA, okay? This is what's going to bring them from a level down here to a level up here. And Hogan's name value would mean a lot in terms of advertisers and sponsors and getting television clearances in other countries. It's going to be a new day. I played a clip on the sound off of the press conference that Dixie Carter did at the time, and she described Hogan's arrival in TNA as the rocket fuel that they needed to make it to the next level, okay? The rocket fuel. Well, guess what happened? Hogan and Bischoff came in, and TNA actually got worse. The first thing they did, they got rid of the six-sided ring, which I never really liked it anyway, to be honest with you, but the very first thing these two guys do is they strip away the identity that the company had established for itself. There were things that TNA did at the time that separated them from WWE. And the six-sided ring was one of them. And the first thing they did was, well, we got to get rid of that ring, brother. So they did that. Fine. They have their own vision of what wrestling should be. TNA brought them in to bring that vision to the forefront. Let's see how things go. Well, look at where TNA was then and look at where they are now. How different are things? Their ratings don't change, and they live and die by those Nielsen numbers. They don't give a fuck about pay-per-view. They have pay-per-views because, in their mind, that's what wrestling companies are supposed to do. You're supposed to have a pay-per-view every single month. So they do it. And they charge people $40-something dollars to buy their pay-per-views. And once upon a time, TNA was known for putting on great pay-per-view shows. You paid to see great, great, great wrestling. Those days are over. I mean, those days have been long gone. You buy a pay-per-view now, and more often than not, you're going to be very disappointed. No, they build everything around their television show, which never, ever, 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 ever goes above a certain level. When they pop a 1.2 or a 1.3 every now and again, they probably do cartwheels in the offices. And we were talking about this 2 years ago, popping the same number and doing the same cartwheels, okay? They have not moved the needle at all. That's why Hogan and Bischoff were brought into TNA in the first place, to move the needle. And they have not done that. And the thing that gets me about Hogan, Hogan is involved with this thing now called Micro Championship Wrestling, which is something with midgets and I don't know. I haven't read all the details. I honestly don't care. But this is his new big venture that he's involved with, okay? And per the deal that he struck with TNA, he's allowed to do outside things on his own. He did his own video game, you know, has nothing to do with TNA, but Hogan's involved in all these different things, and I can understand why. He went through a bad divorce, he's in need of the money, maybe not as much as Ric Flair, but he needs the money, so he does these different things, his name value is exploited, fine. So he's doing this thing called Micro Championship Wrestling now, and he did media in New York this week to promote it. I think it's launching on True TV, the former Court TV. It's going to be having its premiere soon. He was supposed to be on Good Morning America this week. I don't know if he actually was. I have not seen any reports on any websites recapping the appearance. He was on other shows here in New York. He was on a show on NBC on Friday, I believe. And the point is, it was standard Hulk Hogan. He goes on, he promotes his shit, and he doesn't say a single word about TNA. He did the interview in New York on Friday. Not once was TNA brought up. And you can argue, well, you know, he wasn't there to promote TNA and whatever, and the TV, you know, he was there to talk about one thing, and he only had 3 minutes. Bullshit. Look, I'm a PR guy. I have clients that I take on occasion to do television interviews, and they're very strict about, okay, this is what we're going to talk about. We're only going to have X amount of time for the segment. You can go on there and talk about whatever you want. You can go on there and slip a little word in there, slip a little plug in there. There ain't nothing they can do about it. Hogan consistently goes on all of these radio shows and all of these television shows, and 8 times out of 10, he does not say a single word about TNA. He does not mention his affiliation with TNA. I mean, in this interview, it was all about Micro Championship Wrestling and and who's involved. I think Brian Knobbs is going to be involved in a whoop-de-fucking-do over there. The point is, Hogan is doing all of this media that TNA probably envisioned him doing when they first signed him. He doesn't even mention the company. All the talk about Hogan cares about TNA. I want to see TNA grow. I want to see TNA succeed. And I want to see them move on to the next level. Well, the proof is not in the words. The proof is in the actions. And Hogan has proven he does not give a fuck about TNA. He gives a fuck about Hulk Hogan, but he does not give a fuck about TNA. And if that's the case, then he has no value to them at all. They're building to a Sting-Hogan match at Bound for Glory in October. Supposedly, Hogan and Bischoff's contracts are up in November. I say go to Bound for Glory. They shouldn't even be doing the match. But if they're going to do the match, put Sting over Hogan. Because that's the only outcome that makes any sense here. Sting is not going anywhere. Sting is the one legend, who actually deserves a spot in TNA. And has been pretty selfless, I think, in the way that he's conducted himself. Put Sting over Hogan and kick Hogan right out the fucking door. And he can take Bischoff with him. Because Bischoff has been almost as useless to TNA as Hogan has been. What about Ric Flair? Ric Flair has not been used on television much at all in the last couple of months. And there's many different reasons for that. There's that debacle at the Brooklyn show that I was at in July where he didn't come out before the crowd. There were other issues where it's in his contract that he can only appear for so many dates. And if they use him too much, TNA has to pay him more money. And they are paying Flair a lot of money. So by not using him, they don't have to pay him. There's a lot of different things going on behind the scenes. Flair is not very well liked. Not anymore. At first he was, but now people have done a complete 180 on the guy. He is just, he is what he is. And you ask yourself, what value at this point does Ric Flair bring to TNA? He certainly could be a valuable asset. I've complained about the fact that they are finally putting Sting and Flair together for a match. It is the first match between Sting and Flair, legendary rivals in wrestling, okay? Their first match in 10 years. 2001 was their last match on that final Nitro. They've been in TNA for a while now, and they've never crossed paths in the ring one-on-one. They're not going to go out there and have a great match. Neither one of them. More so Flair. Flair, who was once known as being a guy that could wrestle a broomstick in the ring and put on a four-star match. Those days are over. Flair cannot have a great match anymore. It is not going to happen. But there's something to be said for putting Sting and Flair in there together. You know, it's just a nostalgia pop, or, you know, you got to do it one time. And it's something that TNA has wanted to do for years. And now they're finally doing it. And instead of it being on pay-per-view tonight at No Surrender, and maybe making a little bit of money off of it and making it feel special, it just feels more special when you announce that it's on pay-per-view. Because you're announcing to people that this is so good, this is such a special thing that you're going to have to pay for it. But they don't do that. They're putting the match on Impact on Thursday. And they're going to try to pop a rating. Good luck with that, especially now that football is back on. Good luck with that. Once the Sting-Flair match is over, Flair, in my opinion, has very little value left in TNA. If they're not going to use him except for a couple of times a year, it's not worth keeping him under contract for the problems that he is going to cause. Flair has also been a source of more grief than anything else for TNA. And he's out for his own interests. God knows the guy needs money. Does Flair really care about TNA? I don't believe he does. I say get rid of him. Kurt Angle. And it pains me to say this because I was in the same camp of Paul Heyman. I mean, I was the guy who always said Kurt Angle, he's older, his body is breaking down. For Kurt's sake, he probably shouldn't be wrestling anymore. Certainly not a full-time schedule. And believe me, in TNA, it's not anything like the WWE schedule. But for the most part, Kurt is still pretty much a full-time performer. He probably should not be. And I've always said that Kurt is that one legend, that one guy from the past who can still go out there and have great matches. And Kurt has had some phenomenal matches in TNA. He's had matches with the phenomenal AJ Styles, with, I was going to say Mr. Anderson, but actually he has had some pretty great matches with Mr. Anderson, largely in part to Kurt Angle, not so much Anderson. I'm not really a fan, but he's had some great battles. And at this point, you take a step back and you say to yourself, is it worth it? Angle just got arrested for the third time under your watch, if you're TNA, okay? As a contracted performer, he has been arrested three times. Kurt Angle is a disaster waiting to happen. The guy, and I met him in person a couple of years ago, so I can vouch for this personally. I look in the guy's eyes, and it scares me, because it's almost like he has no soul. I mean, you're looking into his eyes, and it's just blank. It's like there's nothing there. He's got this constant glassy-eyed look that frightens me. It frightens me to know that a person like this, who's been popped three times now for DUI, is behind the wheel of a car and is driving on the road with other people. If I lived in the area where Kurt Angle lived, and I had a wife and I had kids, and they were, you know, she would take them to school and drive around the neighborhood, and I knew that Kurt Angle lived in our neighborhood, I would move. And I shouldn't laugh because it's not funny. Because the guy is a danger to others when he does shit like that. And God knows he's a danger to himself. I mean, he's been a danger to himself going back to when he was in WWE. Because the guy is a machine. He feels as though I have to go out there and steal the show. I have to go out there and be Kurt Angle. He can't be Kurt Angle at 60%. He's got to be Kurt Angle at 100%. And he can't do that because his body will not allow for it. So Kurt does whatever he does. You know, he's admitted before he had problems with painkillers. He claims that one day, he didn't go to rehab or anything, he quit cold turkey. Right? Just like Matt Hardy. His vices just disappeared overnight. He doesn't need help. And now apparently he's got issues with alcohol, which makes me think that he probably was able to get himself off the drugs. But because of that, your problems don't just go away. You're taking the drugs to mask pain of some kind. Physical pain, emotional pain. You can't just erase that. So if you stop taking pain pills, for example, you're going to have to compensate by taking something else to dull the pain. Ergo, perhaps he is going on alcohol binges every night. Apparently he's got issues with alcohol. And the point is, he has embarrassed TNA many times. Many times now. At least with Hogan. For all the shit you can say about Hogan. Hogan has not been arrested, you know. At this point, you need to ask yourself, is it worth it just to keep this guy around because, well, he works well with the young guys and he can have a 4-star match or a 5-star match? I've seen all the 4-star, 5-star, 6-star matches at a Kurt Angle I need to see. It's not worth it to keep him around anymore. It's time for TNA to actually show a set of balls and show these people, and the younger guys too, quite frankly, not just all the old guys, that we're not going to tolerate this shit anymore in our company. Kurt, you're done. I appreciate your time and everything that you've given to TNA, but your time here has come to an end. And cut bait with Kurt Angle. And that might be the best thing that could happen to Kurt, because I don't think WWE would take him back. Not right now. I think they would want him to get his issues sorted out. And him not working for either one of the big companies for a while is probably the best thing that could happen to him. So with Kurt, it's a combination of, I would get rid of him because he's embarrassed my company, but I also think getting rid of him is the best thing for him. And you could say the same thing about Jeff Hardy. Jeff Hardy has constantly embarrassed TNA. He embarrassed TNA the first time he was in the company many, many years ago, before he went back to WWE. He came back to TNA. He's embarrassed them again, too. That fiasco, to me, I can't get over what happened in February. It was so ridiculous that they even allowed him to go out there. I can't even lay all the blame on Jeff Hardy. TNA is as responsible for that as anybody. But what happened in February was inexcusable. And the fact that they even hired him while these charges were still pending says everything that needs to be said about the dipshits who run this company. But the fact is, Jeff Hardy is the one guy who you can say actually made some sort of impact when he first came in, before they turned him heel and fucked it all up. Jeff actually was somebody who helped their house show numbers. He was somebody that sold some merchandise. I don't know if he's going to be able to get that back now, you know? Maybe he's lost all of that value. Maybe by him coming back now as a babyface, maybe their numbers will start to go up a little bit. Certainly on their ratings, which is the only thing these people live and die by, are those numbers. He hasn't meant shit. That's the thing with TNA. They brought all of these guys in, and they haven't done anything in terms of the ratings. Hogan, Flair, Sting, Angle, Hardy, none of them make those numbers go up because people watch the show, and it's the same old shit. It's the same thing they see every week. Nothing changes. So each one of these guys are not anywhere as valuable as they were when they were in WWE. And yet they can get away with all this stuff and TNA doesn't punish them. Probably because they fear WWE will take them back. And I know WWE would love to take back Jeff Hardy. So hey, what does that say about WWE? But hey, if I actually ran TNA and wanted to do the right thing, that's how I would start. I mean, I probably would start by getting rid of Vince Russo. But in terms of the talent, Hogan, Flair, Bischoff, Angle, Hardy. Have a nice day. Sting, you can stay. And then you build your company around the other guys. Because right now, people don't give a shit about Matt Morgan. They don't give a shit about Crimson. They don't even care about Samoa Joe. You need to start building these guys back up and making people care about them. And it's not going to, believe me, it's not going to be easy. I mean, TNA has a long way to go to build that goodwill back up with wrestling fans, but they can start. They can start right now. And if they don't want to go through the trouble of firing Hogan and Bischoff, then fine. Let their contracts run out in November and bid them farewell. Because right now, I don't see the value that any of these people are bringing to TNA. You can argue, how can you get rid of all these big names? You just want to wipe out all their big names. You'll kill the product. That's the thing. I don't think it's going to matter. I think if you got rid of every single one of the guys I just talked about, they would get the same 1.0 rating. That will not change. But at least you won't focus on them anymore. You'll be forced to focus on guys that actually don't embarrass you and can possibly make you some money down the road. So there you go. I had to get that out of the way. People have asked me to do a show similar to the one I did back on, I think it was episode 127. I did my WWE Big Business Review. I went over everything I would do if I were in charge of WWE with the talent, with the shows, with the developmental. It was a fun show to do, but it was exhausting. And people have wanted me to do one on TNA ever since then. Well, you just got your show right there. I don't think there's anything more that can be said. Because those are the key things TNA has to do. They have to put their foot down. They have to show that they care. They have to show that they have some balls. And I don't think they're going to do that. Something tells me that it's just going to be more of the same. And inevitably, they're going to get embarrassed again. They're going to be the subject of some, you know, TMZ.com story. And they're going to get their name out there, which I guess is what they want. So nothing ever changes. We got some time for a couple of mailbag questions here. Got some good ones this week. Christopher from Newcastle upon Tyne, UK, part of the Triple Threat, has two questions, really. First, he was listening to another wrestling podcast, and they had briefly mentioned that pay-per-view for wrestling might be dead. What do you think an alternative for pay-per-view would be for the wrestling business? And that's a good question, because obviously, even in boxing, when there's a big boxing fight, they still do very big numbers, but everybody has been suffering, or has suffered at different points anyway, from pay-per-view business being really, really dead. And they haven't gotten away from it. You know, boxing pay-per-view is still the biggest surefire way to make money. Same thing for MMA, and wrestling is really no different. I don't think there's any sort of new technological advancement aside from internet broadcasting that really has evolved to a point yet that it can replace pay-per-view. And as far as internet is concerned, it's not rising fast enough. You know, now Dana White of UFC had talked about that before, and how he had made a comment, I think, once upon a time that within 5 years or something, he would envision them doing most of their business for these big events through the internet, and that didn't happen. And let's be honest, 5 years from now, I don't think that that's going to be happening either. But if they can somehow figure out a way to get more people to buy their shows through their own website, let's say, kind of the way WWE does webcasting right now, it could be very big business for them down the road, and they won't have to rely as heavily on the cable companies. And remember, when there's a pay-per-view and whatever they make off of it, the cable company, the cable provider, gets a very big cut of that. Then WWE gets their share of the money, and then they have to divvy it up. They have to pay the performers. The money that WWE itself is left with is not as much as people probably think it is. So internet streaming and internet broadcasting of these events, which is already happening, is nowhere near as big as people thought it would be by now. But if they can figure out a way to change that, that could be the difference maker right there. But I don't see pay-per-view. I mean, just the way that they offer these events and they rely so heavily on pay-per-view, it's all about the big pay-per-view. I don't see that changing, quite frankly, anytime soon. I think it's not dead for wrestling. WrestleMania proved that pay-per-view is not dead. All it proved is that WWE has to do a much better job of promoting their shows and making them feel special. And if you can do that, people will pay money for them. You know, the money in the bank buy rate wasn't as high as I thought it would be, but it was still, I think, 13% higher than the way it was last year. Why? They had one match that they did a very good job of promoting, and it got people excited about something. Now, imagine if they had a pay-per-view where there were two or three matches like that that got people so excited they said, man, I can't miss this show. I'm going to order it. You know, maybe the pay-per-views are not going to do as well as they did 10 years ago, but they could be doing a hell of a lot better. And the second question here, the second part of Christopher's question, at the current moment, apart from the latest B show, Money in the Bank, does WWE make enough money to make their B pay-per-views worthwhile in the long term? The answer is yes. They actually are turning a profit on pretty much most, if not all, of these B shows, which is why they continue to do them. I think I talked about recently that in the past, for many years, their break-even point on these B shows, on really on any pay-per-view, I think, is 75,000 buys. And if you can hit that number, anything you make over that is going to be a profit. So if 75,000 is your break-even point and they do a B show and they get 150,000 buys, they're making money off that show. That 150 may be lower than the 220 they did the year before, so in reality that number sucks, but they're still making money off of it. And Money in the Bank is another example. You know, obviously they made money on that show. It was a little bit higher than what it was last year, but you know, is Night of Champions going to do that? I doubt it. In fact, I'm almost positive Night of Champions probably will do worse than whatever the September pay-per-view was last year did. And that shouldn't be the case because you've got the first ever Triple H CM Punk match, and I feel, again, it's just a wasted match. I know why they did it because of the Nash thing, but still, you know, that's a match that you save for a Survivor Series or a WrestleMania. And even though it's a big match, it should be a much bigger deal than it is. These two guys have never had a match before. There's a certain stigma that people have with these B shows. And they're in many cases, they're just not going to pay money to see it no matter what. But anyway, just to go back to your point really quick, 75,000 was the break-even point, and that has now changed. I believe the break-even point is now, because of the costs, they've been cutting costs on pyrotechnics and stuff like that, so it doesn't cost them as much money for each pay-per-view when they add up all the costs. That number, I think, is down from 75,000 to about 57,000. So it's actually easier for them now to make a profit off of these shows. I still say they need fewer shows, and if you do that, you'll have more time to promote the existing ones, and then more people will buy them, but other people feel differently. Got a letter here from Lasse from Esbo, Finland, who writes in, one of our international listeners. He just listened to the latest sound off from last week and was really happy to hear somebody in the mailbag agree with him about Scott Armstrong's count. It's pissed the hell out of me for years, and I feel a bit bad for saying this, but I was happy when he was released a while back and disappointed when they brought him back. His stupid slow counts ruined some great close falls for me. All I could think was, no one could possibly stay down for such a damn long count. I just wanted to bring this up to show that the one who posted in the mailbag last week was not the only person to have taken a passionate dislike towards Scott Armstrong's style of making the count. So apparently Scott Armstrong is building a legion of haters out there who just do not like the way that he referees a match. And again, I'll try to pay more attention in the future. Maybe now that you pointed it out to me, I'll notice the same things that you notice. But his style of refereeing, you know, never really bothered me. So we'll see. Dylan Siraki writes in. He goes, Salamaster, thanks for putting my question on Sound Off 177. Wanted to ask you something about crowds. Overall, what is the Baltimore, Maryland crowd like for WWE events? I ask this because I am from Baltimore, and you talk about crowds and the people at the events. And he goes on to list some of the events that have had, let's see here, these, I guess these are events that took place in Baltimore. No, nothing stands out to me. I have not gone back and taken a look on YouTube at the events that you listed here in your email. And when I think Baltimore, in all honesty, I mean, I'm sure there have been some classic events from you know, the NWA and even WWF from Baltimore. The only one that stands out to me that I remember as being from Baltimore in terms of pay-per-view was the King of the Ring in 1994. And if I remember correctly, the crowd was actually pretty good on that night, but I just remember that show as being complete shit. That was one of the worst King of the Ring events that they put on. And if you want to be entertained, if you think Michael Cole is bad on commentary, and believe me, he is, there's a different type of awful. There's a whole other league of awful when it comes to announcing. At least in this case, it was actually entertaining, whereas Cole is not entertaining. But if you want to be entertained in a disturbing way, and you've never seen The King of the Ring in 1994, you've got to find a copy of it. And the announce team for that show was Gorilla Monsoon, Randy Savage, and Art Donovan, who apparently was a legendary NFL player from the Baltimore area. I guess he must have played in Baltimore. And some brainiac thought that it would be a wise move to include him on the broadcast team. And clearly this guy had never watched any wrestling before. If he did, it was from the days of Lou Fez and maybe the original Gorgeous George. And he was just a sight to listen to, a sight to see, because when they showed the announcers on TV, he looked confused. He sounded confused, and he actually looked the part, too. And his infamous quote that he repeated over and over again on this pay-per-view, anytime anybody came out to the ring, was, "Hey, Gorilla, how much did this guy weigh?" With that thick accent. He wanted to know how much everybody weighed. And I think at one point he made a comment about how you know, good of an actor these guys are. And he said, "Oh, you know, that must have really hurt." And just really, just, you got to find a copy of this. So unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, Dylan, when I think of Baltimore, I associate Baltimore with Art Donovan. So Donnie writes in to the Sound Off, "I've listened to your podcast since around episode 10. Great stuff. Just wanted to comment on your opinion of Punk's Money in the Bank entrance being the best from last week. I've been to 9 WrestleManias and countless other pay-per-views, and I can honestly say without a shadow of a doubt, Punk's pop was the loudest I've ever heard. You would have thought those 14,000 people were 75,000. The building was literally shaking. Without a doubt, in my top 3 moments at a live event ever, along with Hogan Rock at WrestleMania 18, Undertaker Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania 25, and Mankind Undertaker Hell in a Cell being the others. Have a good one, and keep up the good work." So there you go. Apparently a first-hand account from somebody in the building that night that Punk's pop in Chicago at Money in the Bank was, in fact, one of the biggest of all time. I mean, you can't not watch that entrance and the reaction he got and not picture yourself in his shoes and just get goosebumps thinking about it. Got a letter here from Bill to clear up some of the controversy from the mailbag last week. Somebody wrote in alleging that WWE had scratched out the WWE Scratch logo on one of their DVDs, and not the F, and Bill wrote in to say that he is by no means an insider, but he remembers that an error was made. He remembers it being mentioned in a WWE stockholders meeting that a new producer at the time made a judgment call to blur the WWE Scratch logo on some DVD offerings. Apparently, the producer was confused about the mandate, and it wasn't made explicitly clear that it was only the WWF Scratch logo that needed to be blurred. If I can find a copy of the stockholders' meeting audio in question, I'll be sure to pass it along. But since WWE doesn't keep a large archive of those files, it may no longer exist. But from all accounts, it was human error. Which, thank you, Bill. It makes sense that that would be what it was, because why would they begin blurring their current logo? It doesn't make any sense. But apparently it may have actually happened, and he didn't just make that up. So that would explain that. Andrew, one of our loyal listeners from Michigan, has been a listener since around episode 18, is celebrating his 33rd birthday on September 20th and asked kindly for a shout-out, so I'm going to give him one right now. It's a little early for a birthday shout-out, but happy birthday, Andrew. Hope you get everything you want. Justin writes into the Sound Off. He's got 2 questions for me. Number one, was recently watching the WWE OMG DVD and wanted to get your thoughts on the Hollywood backlot brawl between Roddy Piper and Goldust at WrestleMania 12. I remember that being a very stiff brawl, actually, between the two of them. And then, of course, the goofy crap they did playing off the O.J. Simpson car chase with the, you know, the bloody white Bronco and, you know, going back to the arena and then Goldust getting stripped down and we find out he's wearing, like, a transvestite outfit underneath. And, I mean, that was really dumb. And actually, in looking back, I mean, that was early 1996, and they had not yet taken that tilt towards Attitude, which I don't really think I think it started happening at the end of 96, when you had all of that tension in the main event scene and Shawn Michaels acting like a prick and Bret Hart bitching about getting screwed the first time and Undertaker and Sid and Steve Austin. But in early 96, it was still more of a kind of a family-friendly product. And, you know, it takes a lot to really offend me, but now that I'm a little bit older, I look back on that. And if I had a kid and I was in attendance that night at WrestleMania and Piper pulled off Goldust clothes and he was wearing what he was wearing, and I had to turn to my kid and explain to him what it all meant, I'd be pretty mortified by that, actually. So I actually think that whole thing was really fucking stupid, quite frankly. The actual brawl in the parking lot, I enjoyed it just because it was something different. And again, it sounded, it felt, it looked like they were really just laying it in on each other. And they weren't holding anything back, which I can appreciate. You know, when you do a brawl, a fight in an alleyway, you should make it feel real. And you should hear the shots connect when you punch somebody in the face and stuff like that. So in that respect, it was something different. I enjoyed it. For those of you who don't know, the early part of that, the actual backlot brawl, was taped. Forgot if it was earlier in the day or possibly the day before. And then when they got to the arena, that, of course, was filmed live. I get that confused with the Boiler Room Brawl back in 96 with Undertaker and Mankind, which I believe the actual Boiler Room Brawl portion of that match was filmed the day before. Or I think it was the afternoon before, actually. And then the day of the pay-per-view, they came, you know, stumbling through the aisleway, making it look as though they had just been brawling. The way it was produced and edited was very slick and very well done. And I know it was very similar for the backlot brawl. Watching it back then, I couldn't notice. You know, I couldn't notice the difference either way. The second question here from Justin, have you ever considered a YouTube version of the Sound Off? I have, and I actually tried a little experiment a couple of weeks ago with an older episode, and it failed. And it basically told me that the episode was too long, which I guess it is. I guess there's some sort of file limit, and you know, any given Sound Off is at least 60 minutes, if not maybe closer to 90 minutes, and I guess it's just too long to go up on YouTube. So there's your answer. Anthony in Frederick, Maryland writes in, another Maryland listener. Dear Solomonster, I wanted to know your take on managers in WWE now as compared to the last time they were around. Why doesn't WWE put managers with talent anymore? And when they do, they then rip them away, like they did when Tamina was with the Usos after only like a month because of her little love affair with Santina. They pulled her away from them. I'm kind of a new listener since around episode 156 and eagerly anticipate the Sound Off every week. It's a good question. I've talked about managers before and how WWE is really dropping the ball by not using them more often. It looks like they may be doing something in that realm as far as Vicky Guerrero is concerned. She perhaps is going to start some sort of faction. I don't know who else would be part of her faction. Right now it's just a bunch of bullshit back and forth with Jack Swagger and Dolph Ziggler, which apparently is leading to a match. Looks like that's a U.S. title match for Night of Champions next weekend. So perhaps after that we'll find out if there's anybody else that she wants to bring into her little stable. But managers are a good thing, and WWE has not traditionally seen it that way. Vince McMahon looks at managers and thinks it's an old-school, you know, wrestling gimmick that doesn't work in 2011. Meanwhile, you've got a ton of people on the roster who either speak very poor English, or perhaps no English at all if you're the original Sin Cara, and or people who just aren't very good at promos. A lot of those NXT guys, I mean, they had a... It was on maybe the second or third, maybe the second season, the season with Percy Watson and Eli Cottonwood and all that. And I remember one segment in particular when they had the guys in the ring and they had to cut a promo. It was like a spur of the moment thing. I think they gave you a word or a subject, like mustache. I remember this infamous mustache promo by Eli Cottonwood where he was talking about how, and I could be messing this up, but he was talking about how, you know, he doesn't have a mustache, but, you know, this and that. And then, like, 30 seconds later, he mentions, you know, I've got a mustache. It's like, well, do you have a mustache or not? Look in the fucking mirror. I think it's pretty obvious that you have a mustache. Anyway, they were just terrible. Pretty much everybody was terrible on promos. And it just goes to show you that it's really either have it or you don't. You know, there are certain guys that have it. CM Punk has it. The Rock, he's in another stratosphere. John Cena has it when he wants to have it. The Miz has it. John Morrison does not have it. You know, I hate picking on the guy, but it's true. You have all these guys on Raw that they're pushing. R-Truth, who was a mid-carder for life in WWE, he got a shot. And guess what? His promos are entertaining as all hell. You know, a lot of the guys that have been getting a shot have been taking the ball and running with it. And Morrison is still a guy who he's not, in terms of that, he's not going anywhere. And perhaps he could benefit from a manager. I mean, there's plenty of other people who could benefit from having a Bobby Heenan-type manager who will, you know, do anything for their guy and go on TV and make people, just talk people into the building. You know what I mean? Heenan is one of those guys. He's a once-in-a-lifetime performer, but there's a reason why Bobby Heenan literally managed like 40 different guys at various points in WWE. And at one point when the Heenan family was an actual faction, I mean, he was the manager for Haku, actually the Islanders tag team, which was Haku and Tama, Andre the Giant, Rick Rude, Mr. Perfect, Harley Race, John Studd, Hercules before he sold him off to Ted DiBiase, Terry Taylor before he, you know, transformed, I guess, his metamorphosis into the Red Rooster, his career died. There's a reason that Vince decided you're a Heenan guy. It was because Heenan knew what his role was as a manager. And everybody that he ever managed raved about him. King Kong Bundy is another one. The only person apparently who ever had a problem with Bobby Heenan was Rick Rude. And Heenan's talked about the fact that Rude actually felt like Heenan was glomming some of his heat off of him. So it's like when Heenan would do interviews and such, he was doing it to draw attention to himself, and he was taking heat away from Rick Rude, which of course was just stupid. I mean, the fact that Rick Rude would even think that is completely retarded, in my opinion. But why they don't do it more often, the buck stops at Vince McMahon. I mean, ultimately, there are people who work backstage in WWE who would love to bring managers back and think it's a great idea. Triple H may well be one of those guys. You know, he's an old school kind of guy. Doesn't matter though if Vince McMahon or Stephanie McMahon is against the idea. And my hope, not that I'm a fan of this angle right now with Swagger and Dolph, I'm really not, but my hope is that if anything positive comes out of that, it's that Vicky perhaps will start managing some people, and if that goes well, then maybe on SmackDown they'll do something with managers on that show. And they could actually help some guys out, because that's one of those things that used to be done in wrestling that isn't anymore, and it's really killing the business, in my opinion. We need more managers, not less. Mike from Carlisle, Kentucky writes in. He's been a Solomaniac since episode 127. That's kind of ironic. I mentioned that episode a little earlier on. Love the show, and his brother Mark is also a listener. Mark is currently serving us over in Iraq in the U.S. Army as an MP. His question is, with the current storyline with Kevin Nash getting fired on television, then getting released several days later, is this just kayfabe, or did money really screw Nash out of what might have been his last hurrah? And as I'm sure many of you have probably realized by now, it is a work. It is part of the storyline. Kevin Nash did not really get fired. And I thought it was a dead giveaway when WWE.com put the story up on, I guess it would have been Wednesday. And the dateline on the item, instead of saying September 7th, was September 5th, which was Monday, which was the day that on television he got fired. So it wasn't even like, you know, I think the item said as of September 5th, you know, Kevin Nash, we wish him well in his future endeavors or whatever. If it would have been like as of today, then maybe it would have given me some pause. But as soon as I saw that Monday's date was given, I knew right away. Yeah, there was maybe a little bit of doubt in the back of my mind. But I had pretty much determined at that point this is part of the storyline. And the other thing to consider also is apparently, from what I understand, Nash has never, at least not yet, actually signed a talent contract with WWE. He was signed to a Legends deal when he came back. Remember in January, he was in the Royal Rumble, got a big reaction. It was around that time he signed a Legends deal with them, which is completely different than a regular talent contract. They're just two distinctly different things. And Nash has a Legends deal, but no regular contract, which is interesting. So there's nothing to fire him from. You know, when they say he's released or we've, you know, whatever, he never signed a real contract. So, yeah, the whole thing is made up. Nash apparently is going to be filming a movie in the next couple of weeks. And that also played a role in why he was fired on television. The reason he was taken out of the Punk match at the pay-per-view, which, again, was incredibly dumb, that was because of a medical issue that came up, and they were not going to put him in the ring until it was cleared up, which apparently he'll be okay in about 2 or 3 months. But the reason they went and fired him on Monday was because he's got this movie role, and supposedly the... I guess the studio or whatever, he could not be insured if he was going to do anything physical on television. So in order to avoid any sort of problems with the movie company or the insurance company, they just decided to fire him and just take him off television entirely, which if that story is true, that tells me that he will not be at Night of Champions. I thought it was a given that Nash would do some sort of run-in, and maybe he will, but if that's true, I would not expect that to happen. Gary writes in, just wanted your thoughts on the WWE possibly turning the WrestleMania showdown between Cena and Rock into a best of three series, the first encounter at WrestleMania, next one at the following pay-per-view, and then a third at SummerSlam 2012. Love the show. Full speed ahead to 200. I'm okay with that. You know, as long as nothing is done to fuck up the WrestleMania match, which they've been promoting all year long, they're banking their entire show next year on this one match. Although I will argue that if, you know, Austin vs. Punk is cleared for WrestleMania next year and WWE is still hoping that match happens, you know, that's a match that to me, even without the year buildup that Rock Cena has had, I'd be looking forward to that match every bit as much, if not more so, than Rock vs. Cena. It automatically becomes a two-match show if that match were to happen. But, you know, I'm fine with that. The more we get to see The Rock wrestle... And it's been many years since we've seen him wrestle, but I'm sure he's hardly lost a step in the ring. He looks like he's in tremendous physical condition. And it wasn't like Rock was some sort of, you know, wizard in the ring. He was what he was. You know, he would go in there, he would, you know, kick ass. He had his special moves that he would do like everybody else has. But he knew how to work the crowd, and people love the guy. So if he comes back and does his thing, I would love to see The Rock wrestle, you know, on half the pay-per-views next year if they could get him. They won't be able to get him for that many of them, but it does present an interesting question, though, because if there is a commitment and Rock has agreed to do, let's say, three matches on pay-per-view, then, you know, to me it becomes obvious who goes over at WrestleMania. You know, it no longer becomes an issue of, well, if they're only going to have one match, Cena has to win because Rock is not going to be here after this. And Cena's our guy. How can we put The Rock over Cena when Cena, we're building him, you know, I think of building to the future, which is comical since Cena's been on top for like 8 years now. But he is the present, and to WWE, he is the future. And you really, as much as I would love to see Rock go over, and from a character perspective, I'm as sick of Cena as you are, it makes no sense for Rock to win, and WrestleMania is in Miami. So are you really going to go into Miami, Rock's hometown, and have John Cena beat him in the main event and expect nothing more than just a livid reaction from the fans when the match is over? If they do three-match series, all of a sudden, you've got a little bit of leeway now. Now, there's no reason for Rock to lose at WrestleMania. They could have a great match. Rock wins. The place goes nuts. Cena wins match number two. The rubber match is at SummerSlam. Cena should then go over at SummerSlam as well. I actually would be perfectly fine with that. It's just like the Survivor Series thing. Part of me, you know, really doesn't think Rock's going to wrestle, but if he does, if it's done correctly, I have no problem with it. I just, you know, the question is WWE going to do the right thing? That's a question that is a little more difficult to answer. Got a question here from Jacob, dear Solomonster. Do you think Shannon Moore will get arrested or caught with drugs or go crazy like Matt Hardy, Jeff Hardy, and Shane Helms? I don't know. It's kind of a weird question to ask. Although I do think it's kind of funny, actually, that the if you took a family portrait of the Carolina Cocaine Crew, as I call them, all those buddies that are down there, Matt and Jeff and Shane Helms and Shannon Moore, and they've got their friend Marty Garner, the whole group, the whole batch of them, and you took a picture of them, you would think that all of them pretty much look normal, and the one guy that would stand out would probably be Shannon Moore, you know, and somebody who is quick to judge a book by its cover would take a look at that and go, my God, what's wrong with that guy? He's wearing, you know, eyeliner and lip liner, and he's got piercings all over the place, and my God, he's got a mohawk. He looks like a freak. And the funny thing about it is, like you pointed out, Matt has had issues, Jeff has had issues, Shane Helms has ongoing issues, and Shannon Moore is the one guy you really don't hear anything about. He seems to be the most normal one of the bunch, which I think is kind of ironic. Adrian from Trinidad, West Indies, writes in your opinion, what pisses you off most when you hear people bash wrestling? For example, he says, I hate it. Excuse me. I hate it when people say wrestling instead of wrestling. Where do you live that people say wrestling? I've never encountered anybody who said wrestling. I guess if I lived in the South, if they have like a Southern twang, but I don't know. Is that the accent they have down there in Trinidad? I wouldn't think so, but. Now, I haven't heard anybody say wrestling, but I will say something that I am amused by. And this actually happened to me about, 2 weeks ago, maybe. I was actually talking to a friend of mine who used to run a wrestling website during the Attitude Era. Actually, it was probably he probably stopped doing it right before the wrestling boom really hit, like in 98. But he used to be a big wrestling fan. He's not anymore. And we were talking, and the subject of wrestling came up. And we were talking about, I think, oh, he didn't know Bret Hart came back, and I was telling him, you know, Shawn Michaels retired. He didn't know any of this. And we were talking about Shawn's last match, I think, with Undertaker, and what a great match it was. And I was talking to my other friend across the table, who also is not as big of a wrestling fan as he used to be, but he at least knows what's going on. He's kind of still a fan, like a casual fan. And we're talking about how great this match was, and I of course, am raving about it. It's still one of my all-time favorite matches. And my other friend, the one who used to run the wrestling site, butts in, and he's, you know, he's saying, well, you know, that sounds like a great match. I'm sure it was really great. You know, even though it is, I'm sure the outcome was predetermined. The outcome was predetermined, right? And I just kind of looked at him, and I didn't know how to react to it, but I was laughing on the inside because there are a lot of people out there, whether they want to admit it or not, okay? You and I both know that wrestling is fake, and I hate using the word fake just because I think fake means everything about it is fake, and as we well know, I mean, I report it on this show every week. The wrestling business is more real than anybody has any business knowing about, especially when you find out about all the backstage shit that goes down. That's real right there. But the reason I hate the word fake typically, even though I'm guilty of using it, is that obviously people get hurt, the injuries are real, and I hate it when people think all of the injuries are fake, because to me it's such a huge slap in the face. So I tend to say predetermined or you know, choreographed, which also isn't completely accurate. But anyway, the point is, people love to think, wow, what a bunch of idiots wrestling fans are. What a bunch of, you know, stupid, uneducated virgins. If you're a wrestling fan, there's a lot of people out there who tend to think that about you, okay? I've heard that argument before. And these are people who can't believe that they don't, oh, but God, these people are such morons. They don't realize that it's fake. What are you, 5 years old? Are the same people that if you talk to them and you're having a conversation, they'll be like, well, you know, wrestling's fake, right? Like, it is fake, isn't it? And you know that deep down inside, they are not even convinced that wrestling is fake. But since it's a cool thing to kind of mock people and bash people who are wrestling fans, they go out of their way to, you know, say all this stupid shit and all this other stuff. But deep down inside, those are the people who tend to think that wrestling might actually still be real. That right there is the definition of the word irony to me. And I don't know. I guess that's not what pisses me off the most. That's more of an amusing thing. I guess what pisses me off the most is just just the lack of disrespect, basically. You know, it's one thing not to be a wrestling fan, but to completely shit on it and to, every wrestling fan is gay or every wrestling fan is, you know, needs to get laid and all this other stuff. Hey, believe me. There are plenty of wrestling fans out there that would fall into that category, but you're painting with a very broad brush when you do that sort of thing. You can say the same thing about people who like comic books or people who like, you know, certain genres of movies, if you're like a sci-fi movie fan or something like that. There's just a lot of ignorant assholes out there. I tend to tune them out, not pay any attention. Like what you want to like. You know, if wrestling isn't your thing but some other sport is, then have at it. You know, have a blast. I'm not gonna judge you. I'm not going to bash you for it. But believe me, the people out there who tend to throw stones are usually the people who deep down They aren't so sure about what wrestling is, and I find that kind of funny. Asir from India writes in, been a listener since around episode 60, huge fan. Which position of the announcer's table do you like the most? Near the ring, where they can see the action closely and call it from there, or the WCW Nitro position, near the stage where the announcers have to watch the monitor and call the action? Also, sometime around 2003, the Raw announcer's table was moved to the position near the stage. Was that due to Bischoff being the GM and Raw, and made to look more Nitro-esque? Was that because of Bischoff? I always thought that it had something to do. I don't know if it was a suggestion that Bischoff made, because Bischoff was there as strictly as a talent and has talked about the fact that nobody ever asked him for his opinion. Which, judging by his most recent track record, it's pretty apparent why Vince McMahon never asked Eric Bischoff for his opinion on anything creatively. But I am a fan of the announcers being at ringside. And that's in part because of the fact, people getting thrown on the announce table, or every now and then if there's some sort of angle they're doing and a wrestler goes over to an announcer and, like, pie-faces him or something, I think that's kind of cool. I think it makes sense for the announcers to be at ringside. I could never understand. It was a great visual in the days of WCW Monday Nitro when they would have the three-man booth, Tony Schiavone's in the middle, there's Bobby Heenan to his left, and Mike Tenado was right, and you'd have in the background all the fans. But it always puzzled me why you would put your announcers in the arena with their back turned to the ring. Does that make any sense at all? I mean, as an announcer, the general rule is you look at the monitor. Jim Ross talks about this all the time. So even though Jim Ross and Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler are sitting at ringside, they watch the monitors. Because from a television perspective, they're commenting on what we're watching. So if they're looking up at the ring and they're commenting about what they're seeing, it may not be what you and I are watching on television. So you have to watch the monitor. You can't just look up all the time. But the reality is, just the position of the announcers back in the WCW Nitro days was always puzzling to me. I mean, they were sitting there, basically, for all intents and purposes, facing the aisleway. They were turned a little bit, but they were facing the aisleway. Their backs were turned to the action. And they were going to be watching the monitors no matter what. But it was just a very bizarre position for them to be in. I always thought that. And when they moved the Raw announcers in 03 to the stage, which they hated. I mean, they hated that position. Because, of course, when Kane would come out, and just look at Kane, let alone Booker T or anybody else that had that hot, flaming pyro. Imagine, I've been to wrestling events where I'm never in the front row, but I'm kind of close. And you feel the heat all the way back there. Can you imagine what it must be like if you were Jim Ross or Jerry Lawler back in the day sitting next to the stage when those flames go off? Or any sort of pyro, even the pyro at the beginning of the show. The heat and the noise in your ears. I mean, I just never liked the announcers being over there. I was never a big fan of that. I was very, very happy when they moved them back down to ringside. We'll take one more question here. This one comes from Matt. Actually, a two-parter. He recently rewatched the Steve Austin Kane First Blood match from the King of the Ring in 1998, and it sparked a couple of questions. Austin has his elbow taped up due to a staph infection, according to Jim Ross. Did he really have a staph infection, and do you know how he got it? In a somewhat related question, for the last couple of weeks, CM Punk has been performing with his elbow taped similarly to Austin's. Does he have any type of elbow injury? I have not heard of any sort of injury for Punk, or staph infection for that matter, so I never pay attention with it to Punk, to be honest with you, because Punk's hands and his wrists are always taped up. That was kind of the joke that Tony Atlas once made. I think it was in OVW when Punk was there. And they brought in Tony Atlas to be, kind of like an agent or a trainer. And it became very obvious to the people down there very quickly that Tony Atlas did not pay any attention at all to the on-air product, because he singled CM Punk out. He was picking on Punk. And he said, why do you tape your arms and your fists up like that? You look like your hands are broken. You'll never be on TV like that. And, of course, that was funny, as Punk pointed out, because at the time, even though he was still down there, Punk was actually on television already. He had debuted already in ECW. So, clearly, Tony Atlas did not know what the fuck he was talking about. But Punk has worn that tape on his hands and his arms for so long that I never even noticed it, to be honest with you. So I don't know. As far as the First Blood match at the King of the Ring, Austin did have a staph infection. It was actually quite serious. I believe he was hospitalized for it. And if you look, it wasn't just basic padding. I mean, he had a lot of padding on that elbow and probably shouldn't have even been back at that point. But, you know, taking him out of the pay-per-view main event was not an option. So the injury was actually legit. As a matter of fact, I remember Undertaker getting a pretty bad staph infection around the summer of 96. It was either after or before. I think it was after the Boiler Room Brawl. And he was out for a little bit. He also, I think, was hospitalized for that. Staph infections are... They're not fun. As far as how Austin got his, I have no idea. But typically, it's a problem in wrestling, more so in the independents. I hear a lot of stories about that. And that has more to do with hygiene and how sanitary the ring mats are. Samoa Joe, I remember within the last year and a half or 2 years, he had a very bad staph infection. A lot of times it comes from just wrestling on a canvas that has not been properly cleaned. There's a lot of germs, bacteria, blood, and whatnot. WWE does a very good job of cleaning their mats, and they have a no-blood policy now. But it still happens. You can get a staph infection from working out at the gym, you know. And there are people who have died from that. It's a very serious thing. You need to take care of that if you ever get one. Second question here from Matt. How in God's name was Mick Foley able to go back out that night after his Hell in a Cell match? As a young WWE fan, that was one of those moments where I couldn't differentiate reality from performance. Foley himself has said that he was never the same after that match. Even now, I can't logically understand how he was able to stand on his own feet that night, let alone run to the ring and brawl with Steve Austin. You know, you and I both. I've seen that match. I think I watched that match about 5 or 6 months ago. And King of the Ring 98 is one of my favorite King of the Ring shows. It just felt like it was a big show, you know. There was a lot going on, and obviously that Hell in a Cell match will live on in infamy. But I remember watching the first Blood match and completely forgetting that Foley would come down later on, because it had been so many years since I had seen it. And when I saw Foley in his Mankind gear without the mask coming down the aisle, my jaw dropped, because I completely forgot he was coming out. And I couldn't believe that he was coming out after what he had went through earlier in the night. You know, and Foley has admitted that he had a lot of memory loss. He didn't remember much of that Hell in a Cell match, I think, after that second bump through the cage. He was in a bad, bad shape. Why WWE would even allow him to come out is questionable. If they had him penciled in to interfere in that main event, they could have put somebody else in that spot. When they saw how fucked up he was physically and he got to the back, they should have called an audible and said, all right, you ain't going back out there. But there he was, you know, they sent him back out. He did his spots, you know, he didn't collapse or fall over or anything like that. In fact, when the pay-per-view went off the air, Austin, he brawled some more with Steve Austin, and Austin gave him a Stone Cold Stunner. So even when the pay-per-view went off the air, Foley's work for the night was not done. Austin left, and Foley had to be taken from the ringside area by two people. You know, he was standing up, and one guy under each arm, and they you know, including Dr. Francois Petit. I remember that. He was the doctor in WWE at the time. He was the guy with the ponytail. So that's going to do it for the mailbag this week. Some great questions. I want to keep hearing from you guys. You can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter. I've posted some pretty amusing photos in the last day or two, including one of Ric Flair. And my goodness, Ric Flair he's really aging poorly. You got to take a look at this photo. You can go to twitter.com/solemonster, or I guess the proper way of saying it is @solemonster on Twitter. And you can friend me on Facebook. As always, it is facebook.com/thesolemonster, all one word. Send me a friend request if you are a fan of the show, and I will approve you, and you can be part of our little community and all the fun we have there. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes for free. Type in Solemonster Sounds Off. You click the subscribe button or whatever it is. It's been a while since I've done that. And all of the shows will be downloaded for you automatically. You will never, ever miss an edition of the Sound Off. If there's a bonus show that goes up, which happens on occasion, on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and you go to SE Scoops and it's not stickied and it gets bumped all the way down to the bottom of the page and you are not aware of it. If you are an iTunes subscriber, you don't have to worry about that. So get on there, and if you do, you will become a member of the Triple Threat, which is an elite group that I am maintaining here on SEScoops.com. Limited membership in the Triple Threat. I don't just let anybody in. So I want to thank everybody for listening. I know I ranted a lot. I just really, it was not a great week for wrestling. You know, again, Raw was a terrible show on Monday. TNA is as inept as ever. And, I mean, that comes as a shock to nobody. But at the end of the day, on a day like today, all of that is minor, you know, compared to as much more important things in the world to worry about. Today's one of those days that you just take a moment to kind of reflect back on what happened 10 years ago today and how all of our lives changed. I mean, even if you're not an American, quite frankly, that one event on that one day 10 years ago on 9/11 changed the entire way the world worked, you know, in many ways for the worse. And it affects our lives even today. You know, go to any airport, try to get through airport security. Guess what? It wasn't that hard before 9/11. We're still feeling the effects of what happened that day. But it's also, like I said, one of those things that puts things in perspective for you. And I could sit here and bitch every single week about WWE and TNA, and the reason I can do that is because we have those freedoms here in this country. And never lose sight of that fact. I certainly have not. Our thanks to our men and women fighting all over the world so that we don't have to. With that, I leave you this week, as I mentioned earlier, with some powerful words from Jon Stewart, the very first edition of The Daily Show that aired after the September 11th attacks back in 2001. This is only a snippet of it. You can find the full audio online. Be well, stay safe, and most importantly, never forget.
Whatever barriers we put up are gone, even if it's just momentary. And we're judging people by not the color of their skin, but the content of their character. And you know, all this talk about these guys are criminal masterminds. They've gotten together and their extraordinary guile and their wit and their skill. It's a lie. Any fool can blow something up. Any fool can destroy. But to see these guys, these firefighters, these policemen, and people from all over the country, literally with buckets rebuilding, that's extraordinary. And that's why we've already won. They can't, it's light. It's democracy. It's we've already won. They can't shut that down. They live in chaos. And chaos, it can't sustain itself. It never could. It's too easy and it's too unsatisfying. The view from my apartment was the World Trade Center. And now it's gone. And they attacked it. This symbol of American ingenuity and strength and labor and imagination and commerce. And it is gone. But you know what the view is now? The Statue of Liberty. The view from the south of Manhattan is now the Statue of Liberty. You can't beat that.